Hello, Movies 101 listeners, Nathan Weinbender here. A quick note about this episode, a look at the 50th anniversary of Chinatown. We recorded it before the death of screenwriter Robert Towne, which happened just a few days ago and so isn't mentioned in the show. Consider this a retroactive memorial to a storyteller who had an enormous impact on 1970s cinema. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart. I don't know what else to say about myself.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender. I can tell you what I'll say about myself. I'm also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio. Yeah.
And, well, welcome to Movies 101, the show that recognizes how times have changed and cultural tastes with them. That evolution applies particularly to the movie business, and in many ways it's justified. That said, some movies, in their time, were considered amazing feats of cinematic art. And Roman Polanski's 1974 film Chinatown, based on an Oscar-winning screenplay by Robert Towne and starring Jack Nicholson, Faye Dunaway, and John Huston, is a prime example. So let's delve into the film itself and why, in so many ways, it holds up, even given so many of today's cultural concerns. Chinatown was released on June 20th, 1974, and it was a milestone in the careers of director Roman Polanski, screenwriter Robert Towne, and the two main actors, Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway. All had enjoyed some prior success, and only Towne was awarded an Academy Award for his efforts, although all were nominated, including the picture itself. But Chinatown was a sensation, and over the years has, as the late Roger Ebert declared, earned the right to settle easily beside the original noirs. And that, he added, is a compliment. Retelling the real-life story of the deal that took, some would say stole, water from the Owens Valley to fuel the development of the arid area destined to become Greater Los Angeles, the movie has historical roots. Towne's script uses that backdrop to tell the tale of a shady private eye, played by Nicholson, who stumbles onto the deal by way of Dunaway's character and her father, the unscrupulous Noah Cross, played by the inestimable Huston. Towne was at first unhappy with the ending that Polanski insisted on giving the film, and it has one of the most obvious and unnecessary climactic lines in film history.
In your opinion.
No, not just mine. But nothing, not even today's cancel culture, can change the fact that Chinatown is one of the greatest films ever made, regardless of genre.
Well, I don't know who's trying to cancel Chinatown since we're talking about it now, but that's beside the point. I also want to go back to your line about the unnecessary closing. I guess I'll say line again, because should we say it? Can we say the line?
Of course we can.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
It's
classic.
Just so unnecessary.
But it's one of the most memorable lines ever.
Because it's such a terrible line. It's
no.
Like the whole movie is leading up to that point. Why do you need to say that?
Well,
it's
I'm so happy
such
a
stupid line.
Our discussion of this is off to such a great start, but I'll get going, I guess. As we've been preparing for this show, I've just been thinking, I don't even know what to say about this movie that hasn't already been said. It's one of those movies that has just been written about and mythologized and dissected and analyzed, and there are all these different interpretations of it and what it's actually about and the historical accuracy and all of that stuff, which makes it such a fascinating conundrum of a movie. But I've been thinking about it within the context of coming out right in the wake of The Godfather, which you said this movie was a sensation, and it wasn't even as big a sensation as The Godfather was. But I was just thinking about the fact that it must have been greenlit because The Godfather was so huge. I think at the time Chinatown went into production, The Godfather was still the highest grossing film of all time, which was a title it held for just a little brief period there. But both were Paramount Pictures. Both were productions that involved Robert Evans, who is the sole credited producer on this. And both were crime epics that were set in America around the same time. Chinatown right before World War II, The Godfather right after. And both films, I think, have this kind of mythic quality about them, and not just in terms of the way that they came together as actual films, but just in the way they're told. They're almost like Greek tragedies, these big over-the-top spectacles of violence and debauchery and bad manners and everything you can imagine. And so I kind of have always thought of them as two peas in the same bizarre pod, even though, of course, The Godfather Part II would come out the same year as Chinatown. I mean, what an incredible era for American films.
Yep.
And I think that looking back at it now, Chinatown is very much, even though it is set in the late 1930s, it's very much about the paranoia and distrust of its time. It is a distinctly 70s motion picture. I mean, the idea that all systems of power are actually deeply corrupt is a timeless idea, mm-hmm. I think, whether it's about the
whether
American
Roman
government.
Times or...
Exactly. Whether, yeah. And whether it's about contemporary American government or about water rights in 1930s L.A. And I also find it to be a distinctly American film. You can really feel both Towns and Polanski's disdain for the country at the time. And of course, you know, it was Polanski's second and last film made in America for obvious reasons. And I think both of them are just expressing this feeling that I think a lot of the country was feeling then, which is just, I don't know, it's such a lively movie and just its style and its pacing and its structure, but it's also a very tired movie. Jack Nicholson's performance as Jake Geddes, he just feels like he's seen enough, you know, and it's just one thing after another that he keeps falling into. And I also think that just that bone deep ache that this movie has, it goes all the way back to the noir films that it's referencing. That's what Hollywood was going through in the 1940s and 50s as well, that feeling of...
Well, and I think there's also, if we want to talk about the context and backdrop against which these films were rolled out, it was the Watergate era. And so talk about corruption at the highest levels or what's going on, I mean, this sort of resonated in a different way, I think, for those of us who were sentient human beings during the 1970s, because it was like, whoa, what is the place of organized crime in the world? What is the place of organized crime in government? You know, what's
and
happening there?
And are they maybe one and the same?
Right. Yeah. And so you did have to ask these questions. And this sort of recurring theme about water and water rights, I mean, we're still dealing with this today. I mean, we've seen more recently, like the second season of True Detective, not the best, focused on something similar in terms of development in SoCal and so forth. So I appreciated when it was screened initially. And I think, as you said, if we're going to set it in the 30s, would we make this film the same way? I don't know, because there are these issues certainly involving women and the portrayal of women and who they are and how they are that, you know, would be more challenging for us to accept today. But maybe we do need to understand that things were different.
But Faye Dunaway, she was also on a roll at this time. She had done Bonnie and Clyde. She was about to do Network and win the Oscar for that. She's incredible in this movie. Right. And even though you're right, the character goes through a lot in this film, I think that performance has so much visceral power to it. It's one of her best pieces of...
Well, and it also parallels in some respects the fact that Jack Nicholson himself found out much later in life that the person he thought was his sister was actually his mother. And so there's some...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so, as a matter of fact, he's always been very left-leaning politically, but I remember at one point he said, I'm definitely pro-choice, but I have problems with abortion because I wouldn't be here if that had existed at an earlier point. I'm an illegitimate child, et cetera, et cetera. So that was interesting if we're going to talk about parallels and context as well.
There's so many things to talk about in terms of Chinatown. One of the ones that struck me was the irony. If this is a movie that is brilliantly shot in terms of the cinematography, it feels somewhat muted, but it still captures Los Angeles. It's a prototypical Los Angeles movie, and yet it's bright in that sense, bright Southern California, and it's set up against all these dark themes.
Well, and it's one of those great heat wave movies. Like you said, it's set mostly during the day. It's such a sweaty, sunny movie, and everything feels almost like bleached by the sun. It's like blinding white, and you're looking down at these big, empty concrete reservoirs, and it's just such a, not only a striking image, but a really fascinating kind of reaction to the dark shadows and the black and white of the noir period that it's referencing.
Yeah.
I also, is this a good time to bring up the two Jakes? Can I bring up the
two
Jakes?
Yes, you can.
So if you don't know, Jack Nicholson and Robert Towne came back to this world in 1990 with a movie called The Two Jakes, which was again written by Towne and was directed by Jack Nicholson himself. And it is a deeply strange movie. I had avoided it for a really long time, but I actually watched it for the first time earlier this year, just by coincidence. And it plays like someone remembering the plot of Chinatown while having a really bad fever or something. It's so garish and cartoonish and over the top, and it has like a surrealism to it. And if you read about the very troubled production of The Two Jakes, it might be more interesting than the movie itself. So much happened behind the scenes. And it gets a really bad rap, and it was a massive flop at the time in 1990. But I don't know. It's got a certain eccentricity to it that I kind of admired. And again, it's half the movie that Chinatown was. Yeah, but it's worth seeing out of morbid curiosity.
I'm actually aghast that you would mention The Two Jakes in the same breath as Chinatown.
Hey, it's the sequel. What can I do,
Jake? Yeah, and if you look at Nicholson's filmography, that's almost always ignored.
For good reason.
Well, we should come back and talk about it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
At any rate, that was our discussion of the 50th anniversary of Chinatown. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to talk more about the various people behind the production of Chinatown and other topics. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the cinema classic Chinatown, which was released 50 years ago this month. Let's now consider some of the people who made the movie, at least one of which is now on many people's canceled list. So what do we have to say here? MP, you wanted to emphasize Nicholson and what else he's done in his career.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think Jack Nicholson appeared in 80 films, and I think at one point he was the most nominated male actor for the Academy Awards.
And he's won three of them, correct?
Yes,
two
correct.
Best actor, one supporting.
Right. And so if you look back, I mean, I think the first movie that I remember his being in was Easy Rider.
And that just goes to show you didn't watch the films of Roger Corman, because he was in some terrible movies.
I know, that's
the terror.
Right,
the Raven.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm a little bit
terrible,
younger than
okay.
you are, so I'm just saying. But Chinatown was actually, in the overall scheme of things, relatively early in his career, because it's 74, and putting aside the 60s bad movies that he was in, I mean, Easy Rider, Five Easy Pieces, Carnal Knowledge, The Last Detail.
He had stopped there, what a run.
Right, right. And so then, of course, the things that we remember most, at least I do, certainly The Shining, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, A Few Good Men. And then later he is in About Schmidt and The Departed. And I think that he's one of those actors who said no more. So I think he hasn't done anything in the last 15 years. And people kept reaching out to him, do you want to do this? And he was like, no, I don't. And whether it was because he didn't like what he was seeing in terms of the scripts he was offered, or he was having a problem remembering lines, there have been so many explanations.
He just wanted to sit on the sidelines of L.A. Laker games and
cheer
on his team.
Give us that sardonic smile.
Yeah.
I agree. So, but some of his performances, I mean, he really does demonstrate this range in terms of, you know, just walking that line between you don't know what direction his character is going to go in.
Compare the two roles of Easy Rider. He plays this jocular kind of lawyer, and what he did in A Few Good Men.
Yeah.
Incredibly.
And some of my favorite Nicholson performances. Well, and before I get into that, let's not forget that he was there to basically kickstart the superhero craze as the Joker in Tim Burton's
Batman. Right.
I mean, by all accounts, because I think he took like a percentage of the gross on that movie and made quite a fortune.
And that was 1989,
And he is really fun in that. But some of my favorite, you mentioned some of the all-time great performances by any actor, but some of my favorite kind of lesser known Nicholson performances. I really love him in a 70s Antonioni film called The Passenger.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Maria Schneider.
Yeah.
In another,
that was right after Chinatown.
Yes. Another early Bob Rafelson movie called The King of Marvin Gardens.
Yes.
Where it feels like he's kind of playing a character in a similar vein to what he played in Easy Rider. He's this very morose kind of radio host.
Or Five Easy Pieces.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Those are kind of all of a piece. And, you know, Pritzi's Honor, where he was directed by his Chinatown co-star, John Huston, and a movie that I want to go back and look at, because I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember it being really fun in a campy way, is the Mike Nichols film Wolf, where he plays a man who becomes convinced he's turning into a werewolf. Maybe it sucks. I don't know. But I remember it being kind of fun,
like,
and Nicholson being fun in it.
I was thinking of his small role as playing an astronaut in Terms of Endearment,
which won him his second Oscar.
Yeah. You know, I mean, a guy with a star like that in a movie with Deborah Winger and Shirley MacLaine.
And Danny DeVito and John Lithgow
and
Jeff Daniels.
Jeff Daniels, right, exactly. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about great screenplays, because the Chinatown, particularly the Chinatown that Town wrote without the ending that Polanski pasted on, is a great screenplay.
And
it's
by
a
the
great
way,
screenplay.
There is a book about the production of Chinatown called The Long Goodbye that is apparently very detailed, and I want to read it, that goes into sort of the push and pull between those two guys, and I'm going to have to look at
that. But think of other movies that have great screenplays. William Goldman is a great screenwriter. The Princess Bride is a perfect screenplay. You don't get much better than that.
I was kind of intrigued by this idea of what makes a great screenplay, and maybe even what makes Chinatown a great screenplay, because Chinatown is often cited as the great screenplay of the second half of the 20th century of film, and it's studied all the time. But I was thinking, is it dialogue? Is it story structure? Is it a sense of character that comes off the page like it does in a great novel? And I'm not sure there's one answer. It's got to be all
it's
of those
things. It's the cumulative effect.
Right. And I also think that sometimes we put a lot of the onus on the screenplay when, in fact, as is the case with Chinatown, the screenplay can be great on its own, but then it's the accidents that happen on set. It's the things that they have to compensate for because they're running out of time on that day that make great moments in
films. A perfect example is Casablanca.
Sure.
That should have been a disaster because no one knew what was going on. They were writing the screenplay as it was going on, and yet look what it turned out to be.
Yeah, and that is a film that is so confidently structured that it's surprising to learn that there was, you know, tumult on the set. And I want to talk a little bit about Robert Towne, because he is a fascinating character, and I think one of the architects of the new Hollywood movement of the late 60s and early 70s, but he's not cited nearly as much as many of the directors of the time. And a lot of that's because he was uncredited on a lot of screenplays. He was sort of an in-demand script doctor and did uncredited work on movies like The Parallax View and Marathon Man, speaking of William Goldman, and Warren Beatty's Heaven Can Wait. He was also a co-writer on Bonnie and Clyde. And then The Last Detail, which you mentioned, he's credited on the screenplay for that. And then going all the way into the 90s, he worked with Brian De Palma on the very first Mission Impossible movie. But I'm a big fan, and I've brought it up on this show before, of his directorial debut, 1982's Personal Best.
Personal Best.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a movie
Hemingway.
Yeah, a love story between two track and field runners.
Who was the other actress? Meryl Hemingway?
I can't remember her name, but she was like a one-time performer, and I'll have to look it up. But that's a really good movie and shows that Towne was more than just story structure. He knew how to build characters and settings that felt real and lived in and believable. And that's a movie that people should check out if they haven't seen it.
Well, and I think the one thing that, of course, I would want to talk about and probably would escape maybe your notice is the fact, I mean, Jack Nicholson really was a character in his personal life, his real life. I mean, I think he dated half of the actresses
Hollywood. A slimy guy for sure.
Well, because there were these overlapping, I mean, you think he was with Angelica Houston for like 17 years, right when Chinatown was being made, starring with her dad and, you know, so forth and so on. And, you know, I think the estimate is that he has six acknowledged children, non-marital children, but there are many others that are sort of lurking in the background. And so I think that he was, I mean, Warren Beatty ultimately settled down, but Nicholson never did. And so that was part of his mystique in a way.
And speaking of mystique, that was a tortured segue, but I didn't know what else to do. I want to circle back a little
because
bit
I just got you totally pulled off center. You mean that?
Yeah. By the way, the actress Patrice Donnelly.
Patrice Donnelly. Thank you.
Best.
Great work in Personal Best. I just kind of wanted to talk about the 1970s in general and sort of the wave of, it's now called neo-noir, that was coming out both before and after Chinatown. Chinatown is often cited as the definitive neo-noir film, and I think that's, I would not disagree with that.
Yeah.
And it's sort of at the center of this movement, these movies that were playing into the themes of noir, so private detectives and backroom dealings and corruption and all of these things, but done in a way that was much grittier, much more hard-edged, much more R-rated. The thing that makes Chinatown different from a lot of those was that it was a period piece. And you go back and look at a lot of the neo-noirs from the 70s, they're very much 70s movies, even though I made a case for Chinatown being a film about the 70s being set
Altman's
in the 30s.
The Long Goodbye.
So yeah, we'll start with The Long Goodbye with Elliot Gould. That was a movie that kind of turned the Private Eye movie inside out. It was, what if Altman made, you know, a Raymond Chandler film? But you also have films like Arthur Penn's Night Moves, which has a famously convoluted plot and sort of transplants a traditional noir story into the 1970s and into, you know, swamps of, I think it was in Florida, was that movie. Joseph Sargent's The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, one of the great crime movies that also has
that
sort of a noir edge.
Terribly later.
Very true. Yeah. And then 1972's Serpico, which is unusual in that it's about a cop.
There, Pacino,
cops
Pacino,
were rarely the heroes or the stars in noirs, but Serpico is an interesting case. And then one that I really love, The Friends of Eddie Coyle.
Robert Mitchum,
who was a staple of the original wave of film noir, kind of going back to his roots, but in a much different, more distinctly 70s way.
Well, so since we've had some rough segues, I'm going to introduce another one. And that's his performance in The Shining. So Jack Nicholson performance in The Shining.
I think
here he's working with Kubrick, you know, and apparently Kubrick demanded that he do like 50 takes of some of these different scenes. And then at the same time, Kubrick said, improvise if you want to, and so forth and so on. So his relationship with all of these A-list directors, I think, is also something. The fact that he was able to make these performances pop in alliance or alignment with the directors or in spite of the directors, I think is a really notable feature of his career.
And would it surprise you to know that I had a giant poster of his face from The Shining in my childhood bedroom?
No, not at all.
No, that explains several things.
But not all of them.
Yeah. At any rate, that was our discussion of the 1974 movie Chinatown, which is being shown in select theaters around the country in a 4K restoration. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and I was joined this week's show, as usual, by my co-hosts Nathan Weinbender and Mary Pat Truthart. Let's take this moment to thank Cassia Fox for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the great screenwriter Robert Towne. Good dialogue illuminates what people are not saying. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.